No, I didn't get. We didn't print that.
Love Talk Radio.
I got one. Oh, okay.
So I can find you this song.
Love is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Well, good evening, and welcome to Yada Yada Radio. Happy Shabbat to one and all. I know we're here with Kirk. JB may be joining us a little later. You are the one-eyed man.
Make a good start.
Yeah, you make a good pirate these days. Kirk is having eye surgery and trying to get his vision restored. And you've had a sick wife, I understand.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. She hasn't been doing too well, I can tell you that. But she's
antibiotic reaction that really threw her for a loop. So we're hoping you guys mend. Well, I would ask you a question, Kirk. You know that the United States is the focus of Yeshayahu.
Yes, sir.
Develops and so the entire chapter really devoted to the consequence of what America does, and when Yahweh is calling his people out, he is clearly calling them out of Babylon. You know, it's in Yirmiyah where he says he's calling them out of Babylon, and even as you read the Revelation account of "We're going to come out of her, my people," there's only one place on earth that even comes close to the description. It's just like in Yeshayahu, Babylon is the United States. Politically, one of the things I learned in this past week, however, you've probably heard of the book "The Two Babylons" by Hislop.
It sounds a familiar name.
He's wrong too. There are three Babylons.
Okay.
There is geographic Babylon. There is national or political Babylon. There's religious Babylon. I'm talking about in the last days. Of course, there was one. Actually, there were two Babylons in the Torah and prophets. The first Babylon was the Babylon of Nimrod, where Astarte was and the Trinity was conceived, and where we learned about the concept of Babel, of confusing by commingling. So there was that Babylon. Of course, then there was the Babylon that emerged from the infighting between Sumer and Assyria. Sumer, Assyria, and Babylon were kind of all mixed together, with one or the other being at power at different times. But at the point that Babylon was the principal power, he of course came and destroyed and enslaved the southern kingdom, Yehuda. So that would be the two Babylons of history. But there's three Babylons today. America's political Babylon. They couldn't even make an argument for any other country. The Roman Catholic Church is the beast that grew out of Imperial Rome, and is clearly is religious Babylon. Mm-hmm. But there's geographic Babylon. And Yahweh is calling his people out of all three. And we know that there are 2% of the world's Jewish population lives in America, about 7 million Jews. So it makes sense. They would call, you know, I'm calling my people out, come out of her, my people. God only has one group of people. That's Israel, Yehuda. And so it's not surprising that he would call his people out of America, because he's calling them home to Israel. And then he's telling Israel, I'm informing you of this because you've got to make room for him. That's a perfect fit.
Right.
But did you know that there are millions of ethnic Jews in Roman Catholicism?
I didn't know there were millions, but we talked about this Tirana this week in between everything. And we were thinking about, you know, there's an awful lot of people who convert in order not to die.
That's correct. And, a lot.
And Spain and so forth, and in Italy, they lived in Europe. You converted there, so a lot of them obviously did. So that doesn't surprise me at all.
Right, and so today with really good ancestral studies, there's a bunch of people that are really into the names of places and people, and they can do ancestral studies that way. But, of course, DNA. And there's two haplogroups that are identified with ethnic Jews, and millions of them in Roman Catholic Church. But there's also, and this is a surprise, you would have thought that all of the Jews, you know, that were left in what was old Babylon, you know, Iran area, Iraq area, that when Israel was formed and the last remaining group of them were told, get out of Dodge, you're going to leave everything you have, and either get out or we're going to kill you, that would have been pretty much it for Jews in geographic Babylon.
But that's not right. 50 came.
Oh, 50,000, not even close.
300,000 went, you know, 350 went in, and only 50,000 came out. So.
Correct. And now as we do DNA studies, there are lots and lots of people groups that are living in places that have Hebrew names. Well, look at Yathrib, where Muhammad spent most of his time, that have Hebrew names that we know had large concentrations of Jews, and the DNA proves it. And religiously, for the most part, they're Muslims.
Well,
so they converted to Islam, but they're still Jews by blood.
Yes.
In fact, there's some that are really bizarre. For example, the Pushtun tribe. They are they're the essence, the best fighters, the core of the Taliban.
Really?
Likely Jews.
Wow.
And their principal enemy. There's another tribe there in the Afghanistan area, and they admit that they're Jews. Still, they practice Islam, but they're ethnic Jews. So there are three different Babylons that really he's calling his people out of, and over time we're going to make a pretty conscientious attempt to go through and help identify some of these people. Personally, I think that when Yahweh raises his neck, his banner, and calls his people home, that the preponderance of those who come home, maybe 90-plus percent, are going to be socialist, secular, humanist Jews in America. I don't think Yahweh is going to reach or even wants to reach an Orthodox Jew or a Muslim Jew. So I think that knowing that they exist is going to be an interesting study, but and we need to identify them so that at least to those who some of us can think about it. I just don't think we're gonna find a lot of people who are gonna be open to Yahweh's testimony if they're overtly religious, whether it be Roman Catholic or whether they be Muslim.
That's
going to be an interesting, an interesting study. The other thing that we're doing here now, we jumped ahead or jumped back a chapter rather than jumping to the 18th chapter after finishing the 17th. We jumped back to the 15th and 15th. And this is really interesting because Bruce, I asked you, we're talking about America and all the huge role America plays. And there's one chapter of Yahshua God devoted to America. But there are two devoted to Moab. And there's much of Yirmiyah that runs parallel in prophetic insights to Yahshua.
Mm-hmm.
And the 48th chapter of Yirmiyah is devoted entirely to Moab. And then in the Magog War in Ezekiel, guess who one of the participants is? Moab.
It's Moab. Yeah.
Yeah, Moab. And so, in fact, one of the passages that from a minor prophet that we'll run into in this chapter, and I won't tip the hand because it's just way too powerful. It talks about who Moab is in the last days and ultimately destroying them. So Moab is a really big deal, prophetically, a bigger deal than America. You know, so here is something that is more influential, more populous, more popular than the influence of America in the last days, Moab. Just based upon all the things that are said about them. And so it's really important to figure out who these people are. And because it's such a huge swath of prophetic testimony. Many of the things that I've been translating, it says that they're going to be among the first that Yahweh wipes out, and then he's going to go on and deal with other people.
Wow.
So you don't want to be part of Moab.
No.
But it's important to know who they are. And what's interesting about the study of Moab is that there are very few things in all of the Torah and prophets and Psalms that are as instructive as the birth of Moab and the death of Moab. Now, I've sent you this chapter that we're going to jump back into, which is the 11th chapter of the second volume of Observations for Our Time.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, I don't think I've ever experienced anything as powerful as what can be learned in the story that tells us the birth of Moab, or what can be learned when we study the death of Moab. And you probably read some of this chapter, Kirk. When I talk about the birth of Moab, do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, that's the son of the illicit affair, or the incestuous affair of Lot and his oldest daughter.
Right. And it's not just because there's only like three lines that are attributed to the incestual relationship between the two. It's the conclusion of the story of Sodom.
Mm-hmm.
So Moab is the conclusion of the story of Sodom. And then when you read the, and so there's obvious implications is that Moab today is going to resemble a lot of the characteristics that we're going to experience in Sodom, and we're going to find out that what we've been told about the Sodom account ain't so.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Christian fixation on being anti-homosexual, sorry, no homosexuality in Sodom. In fact, there's not even any sex in Sodom.
No, I heard that again today.
No sex at all.
Sorry.
No threat of sex. No restraint from sex.
Mm-hmm.
No, as a matter of fact, it's interesting that that Yahweh's words to describe sexual relations, and there's two words that he uses, both of them are used when it's the daughters doing it with the daddy.
Mm-hmm.
But they aren't the words that are used when we're Lot is dealing with the townsfolk of Sodom. It's just weird how that became a thing when it's just not true. But then when we're going to turn to the death of Moab, and the death of Moab was something I needed to do because I wanted Yahweh to demonstrate, not just history, that Moab didn't exist and hadn't existed for 150 years at the time that Yirmiyah and Yashaya were written. So if Yirmiyah and Yashaya were written 150 years after the kingdom of Moab ceased to exist, then when they're talking about a kingdom in the last days, guess who they're not talking about?
Well, they ain't talking about the Moab up on the hill.
That is correct. They're not talking about the little back country bumpkins on the other side of the Dead Sea. Mm-hmm. It's what Moab represents. And how their demise would shape Israel's future. And that's what we find.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an amazing story. And then when we get into the actual two chapters of Yashaiah, there's only one person who is constantly described. I mean, he's described in every which way. It's kind of like you're reading Habakkuk all over again.
Mm-hmm.
It's everything God can say to tell us why he really dislikes Shaul, Paul.
Yes.
And so the daddy of Moab is Paul.
That's a good conclusion. Agree.
And you know that it's who's your daddy is what Moab means. Paul is obviously the daddy of Christianity.
Right.
And we want to be a little careful there because God has a perfectly good term to use to describe the beast that grew out of Imperial Rome and became the Roman Catholic Church, and it's Esau's descendants or Edom.
Edom, yes.
Yeah, and he's got a name that he uses in conjunction with end times prophecies that describes the Muslims that are all around Israel, Amon. And Amon happens to be the descendants of Ben-Ammi, which was Lot's son that grew out of his incestuous relationship with his youngest daughter, Ben-Ammi, and it's Amon. And we know that's Islam because God equates Moab and says Moab is in Sodom. Moab and Sodom are the same thing. And he says Ben-Ammi Amon is identical to Amora. And Amora, the definition of Amora is the tyrannical governments of Islam. So we have the three different groups. And so you've got Pauline Christianity. But it's just so obvious that it's so much more than that, that, you know, so I was doing this, I said, when you're dealing with Sodom, you're dealing with multiculturalism. Mm-hmm. You're dealing with you know, man's highest calling of man, socialist secular humanism. You're dealing with the arguments that were raised and the mindset, you're dealing with political correctness.
Yes, indeed.
And so my problem was, why is then the only person that's being identified as having fathered Moab, Paul? And it just hit me like a ton of bricks. And this chapter ends with a stunning revelation. And I use the only thing that Paul is ever really credited with, the one thing that even people who will say, okay, I get it, yeah, Paul had some issues, and yeah, Paul probably wasn't inspired, but boy, he's really got some good philosophies. And I say, well, so you're talking about 1 Corinthians chapter 13, his love chapter. Yeah, that's really.
Hello?
Hello?
Still there?
Okay, we are. Oh, looks like Craig dropped. Give him a second. Let's see if he calls back in.
Okay.
Oh, hopefully it doesn't just end the show. Well, it's actually got a countdown thing going. So
oh,
really? In 45 seconds it will end if there's not a host, if the host doesn't call back in. So, hopefully Craig realizes he's not on.
I can't email him. So.
Yeah. I can shoot him an email. I don't know if he'll
get
it.
If you can, yeah, please do.
Am I back? So that everyone can hear. Yep. We had a tree that fell on the power lines. We're still in the world of the caveman here in South Florida, where they have these things called power lines and telephone lines on telephone poles.
Mm.
You've probably seen that before. They haven't figured out how to put them underground yet. They had a.
We have those around where I live.
Yeah, but you don't have hurricanes, nor do you have salt in the air. And so to do it here, where you have hurricanes and salt in the air, is kind of, well, I would call it stupid. Well, my whole neighborhood lost power today, and it looks like in the process of restoring them, they just temporarily cut off my phone line. Yeah. So what I found is that by if you go through every statement that Paul made in his love chapter,
okay,
what you find is that he is the founder. I always thought it was Adam Weishaupt, but it's Paul. Paul is the founder of multiculturalism and of political correctness and of what we would call today socialist secular humanism.
Really?
And it can be proven with Paul's two most famous diatribes, his love chapter, the 13th chapter of 1 Corinthians, and the 13th chapter of Romans, where he glorifies government. And so we're going to find that Moab is Paul. Yeah, the daddy of Moab is Paul, and it is multiculturalism. It is political correctness. It is socialist secular humanism just as much as it is Pauline Christianity. And so collectively, you've got Pauline Christians. If you count Roman Catholics, it's 2.5 billion of them, and a billion multicultural secular humanists.
Mm-hmm.
Half the world's population.
Wow.
So,
thanks.
Yep. Now, there is a lot that we can learn, and one of the things that we talked about a week ago is the fact that Moab is the place. It was Mount Nebo. Now, Mount Nebo is interesting. Nebo is the Babylonian god of Scripture. So, the Babylonian Scriptures today you'd find in the Babel, Christian Bible. And you'd find them in the Babylonian Talmud. And you'd find them in the Quran, which was first written in Babylon. Mount Nebo. And that's where he died. That's the lone voice of the Torah. Moshe died in on Mount Nebo. Mount Nebo is in Moab. And so if we were to fast forward, if Moshe is the principal author and the voice of the Torah, who's the person who's had the greatest influence on silencing the voice of the Torah?
Paul.
You got it. Who's the person who is most responsible today for the for Christianity being a mix of Gnosticism and of pagan theology?
Well, the Gnostic known as Paul.
Yeah, Paul. Yeah, as a matter of fact, you know, I've learned something also in the last couple of days. Do you know that Luke plagiarized the three conversion experiences that he claims Paul endured? You know, that Paul never mentions them. In fact, Paul's testimony in his letters is really hostile to the idea of having a conversion experience. So Paul's letters not only don't present a conversion experience, they're written such that it's very difficult to even fathom that he had one. And so it's a artifact of Luke's writing. Then Luke presents it three different times. He picked it up from 2 Maccabees. It's in 2 Maccabees. The whole story about seeing a vision, being blinded, being made lame, being taken to a place where a righteous Jew prays for him, and then being sent out once he recovers to go on God's vision.
Wow.
The story is 2 Maccabees. And what's interesting about 2 Maccabees is that 2 Maccabees takes the and casts the adversarial Greek leader as Dionysus. And guess whose words Luke put in Dionysus' mouth on the road to Damascus. It's Dionysus. And of course, the whole thing is just utterly preposterous. Jews didn't have the authority to kill Jews in Jerusalem. And Paul wants us to believe that rabbis who had no authority over death of Jews in Jerusalem somehow were authorizing him to go off and kill Jews in Damascus. In another country.
Yeah.
Just, the entire thing is an utter and complete hoax. Yeah, so it's
that's so cool. From a discovery standpoint, it's really
it is. One of the things that's really interesting too is that that a significant portion of Paul's love chapter cites Socrates. For example, the whole bit on seeing in a mirror.
Uh-huh.
It's Socrates. And the Socratic method revolves around that mirror. And come to find out that Socrates, like Paul, also confessed to being demon-possessed. And Socrates was ultimately killed because he was in opposition to the chief god of Athens. Just like he wrote against was Athena, and he was just like Paul. And he's tracked down what Socrates actually wrote, and Paul copied him every which way.
And if you're a liar, what the hey?
What the hey? You know, it's like Muhammad. Muhammad couldn't come up with enough material to fill his Quran, so he just stole it from others and twisted it to suit his particular agenda.
Yeah.
And once you're free of the mythos of Paul, because Paul's a tough guy to go after, you tell anybody, even if they're not a Christian, that the author of 14 books, and I have previously said 13, I was wrong. I've always said that Paul, of course, wrote his 13 epistles, which include his love letters to Timothy, but that one of his underlings wrote Hebrews.
Yeah.
Well, I've done some more study. Paul admits that he's the author of Hebrews. He wrote Hebrews, and it's the most disgusting of all of them. And so, when you're reading this, and you're telling people that it is blatantly obvious that Paul lied, that he never quoted Yosha. He always contradicts God. It's always, but I, Paul, say. There is a zero possibility that he was telling the truth, and 100% assurance that he was lying. Even agnostics look at you like, well, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. Boy, people must hate you for saying that. It's amazing how difficult it is for people to come to grips with Paul. And yet it's, you know, the question Paul now is over 1,000 pages. You could write 10,000 pages and not run out of material.
Going to be a great trial.
Yeah, I don't know if he's worth the time, but yeah, you could go after him forever. Well, anyway, I'm going to pick back up, and we know that Moab is where the Torah's voice died, which is a real important clue as to what it represents. You know, and it's the way that the Torah's voice died in Moab that is so indicting of Pauline Christianity. And you know the story of why Moshe died in Moab and wasn't allowed in the Promised Land?
Well, you can see it, but he struck the rock twice instead of speaking to it. So
right.
I said, you can't twist my words now, guys.
Yeah, it's really simple. And of course, Moshe is having a grand old time with Yahweh now, and he's one of the two or three greatest people in human history. So it's not like, you know, Moshe has paid an eternal price, but for Moshe at, well, whatever he was at that point, 100 plus years old, right? I mean,
absolutely.
Would be 120, right?
20 at least, yeah.
Yeah, 120 at least. Because he left Egypt around 40. He was like 40 years as a shepherd. Was part of the Exodus at 80, and then was 40 years in wandering in the wilderness. 120. And so it's not like he lived one of the greatest lives in all of human history. But Yahweh wanted to make a point that was really unmistakable. That's too bad. Have people have all mistaken it. But the point of Moshe is, you want to get into the Promised Land? Don't twist my words. I mean what I say. You are not at liberty to change my testimony just because you want it a different way. You know, you may not like the fact that that the doorway to life is Pesach. You may not get the religious connection, removing religion and politics and the equation of the fungus of yeast being removed from the bread. That may not trip your trigger. You may wonder, why in the world I'd have a festival feast called Bukurim, firstborn children? You may not like the fact that I've told you that if you want to be part of my family, you've got to give up religion and politics and conspiracies and the like. That you've got to walk away from those things. But guess what? Shiloh's covenant. His universe. His family. What Moshe did is he made a very small variation in God's plan to quench the thirst of his people. And God said, no, you're not coming into the Promised Land. That's to tell the rest of us that we are not at liberty to change this.
Mm-hmm.
God's got a plan. He hates religion. He hates politics. He hates conspiracy. We aren't at liberty to say, well, you know, that's not the way we look at it. You know, the people that even today, a huge percentage of agnostics and atheists celebrate Christmas and Easter and Halloween, St. Valentine's Day. Because they say, it's just a social time to have fun. What's wrong with having some fun? It's not what it means to me. Well, you know, Moshe said, hey, big deal. And also that my staff was the big deal in Egypt. I thought I'd, you know, shake the dust off of it. Tap the rock a couple of times. What's the big deal?
Oh. Big deal.
You know, we're not at liberty to change the Torah. And so when Christians thought that they were in a position to change everything,
really, everything.
Yeah, I was listening to a Muslim theologian. Not listening, I was reading. I was listening because it had been read to me. But a Muslim theologian talking about how the Torah had been annulled, and that, you know, it had been changed and it had been, and we knew that it had been annulled because, you know, it can't be practiced anymore and it's full of contradictions. And I said, hey, Muslim, wake up. Your Quran says 3 or 4 times that it confirms the Torah. If the Torah is not right, then Islam can't be right. So, think it through.
It ain't for you.
It's astonishing, but that's the problem with religion. You know, what is the primary difference between the Talmud and the Torah?
Well, those are arguments against the Torah.
Yes. Oh, what's the difference in Moshe striking the stick versus speaking to it and the Talmud?
He wasn't speaking for the Torah. He wasn't doing what the Torah was suggesting to do.
Right, and the Talmud isn't speaking for the Torah. It's doing it. This is man's interpretation, man's way.
And God hates it.
Yeah, that's the lesson of where the Torah's voice died is that we aren't at liberty to change God's plan. We aren't at liberty to change his name. Change any one of the 7 Moed Mikra, change the Sabbath to Sunday or Friday. We're not at liberty to change any one of the 5 conditions of the covenant. We're at liberty to say, as Paul did, you know, I don't like circumcision unless it's going to be Timothy. And so I'm going to say that if you're circumcised, you can't be saved, with the exception of Timothy, because I really love him. But everybody else, if you're circumcised, you can't be saved. Oh, by the way, I'm happy circumcised, so I guess I can't be saved. But don't pay attention.
Yes.
To what's going on behind that curtain. So if you want to know about Moab, Moab is representative of where the Torah's voice died because the voice of the Torah changed. Something that God said and did it his way. We do not have that luxury. The guy that authorized this and inspired this Torah knew what he was talking about. And he, while he loves his children, he has not given his children the authority to change what he wrote.
No.
Therefore, Yahweh is speaking out expressly against Pauline Christianity, the testimony that is the most aggressively hostile to. And the letters that do the most damage to, those that alter the nature of the Torah. Now this perspective is especially plausible since from Yahweh's perspective, he reaffirmed his covenant with Israel in Moab before Israel crossed into the Promised Land, Devarim 29. And as we know from having studied Yirmiyah 31, which is where Yahweh talks about restoring his covenant one last time upon his return, doing so again with Israel and Yehuda, placing his Torah guidance inside of his covenant children, he's doing it right before what? He meets with them in the Promised Land and celebrates 1,000 years of Sukkah. So as he's returning for the millennial celebration of Sukkah, we would expect him to deal with Moab. So this transition from Moab to Sukkah, from the wilderness to the Promised Land, from man's realm to God's, the abusive and religious nature of what is presently indicative of Moab will be exposed and expunged along the way. These insights demonstrate that Shaul, question him, Paul, was dead wrong when he misrepresented, nullified, and replaced Yahweh's Torah and Moshe's Devarim words with his gospel of grace and what I, Paul, say. But could there be other reasons? What about the fact that Moab was, as you mentioned, Kirk, born to Lot's eldest daughter as a result of an inebriated incestual experience? Right after their escape from Sodom and Amorah. Could this be the lesson of Moab that Yahweh is now teaching? For Abraham's benefit, God spared this man and his family, only to reveal that as a result of the society in which they were indoctrinated, place from which they had lived. Now, you're looking at everybody thinks that, well, you know, his wife looked back, and they always turned to salt for looking back, but it's a pretty mean God. And
yeah,
he didn't look back.
He
didn't look back.
Yeah.
He longed for what she left.
Right. Exactly.
She longed for what she left. As opposed to walking away from it, she wanted to stay there. Even Lot didn't want to leave. And the daughters didn't want to leave.
And they were ushered out by the...
Yeah, their fiancés didn't want to leave. And then when Lot was told, hey, you know, which way you should go is right up there. From Sodom, you look up the hill, it's Olives and Moriah. That's where we ought to go. That's where Abraham is. Go up there. He says, no, that's too much. I can't do that. I was going to go over to here. And, of course, the name of that, the place that he went to, named Lowly and Little.
Yeah.
Now, from the beginning to end, the whole story is just amazing.
Yes, it is. Wow.
Yeah. You know, the Christians are wont to believe that the story of Lot is symbolic of their rapture. Another concept that Paul got wrong. That there represents the godly Christian that's going to be saved. No. Lot was a scallywag. As were his daughters. No. Lot didn't want to go where he was supposed to go. Lot didn't want to leave town. The only reason that Lot was spared was because Yahweh made a promise that he would do so to Abraham, because, you know, that's what family does for family. And that was the only reason of that, and to tell us an amazing story in terms of how Moab would come to be, and therefore what Moab represents and what God hates. And God makes it really clear that just as he destroyed Sodom, he's going to destroy Moab. Now, you better have your fire and brimstone suit on if you're any of the things that it includes. So they remained as corrupt as the place where they had lived. The fact is, Lot was immoral. He was irrational, explicitly telling those seeking to confront Yahweh's messengers that they should consider his daughters instead. And when they were denied, he himself had sex with them, giving rise to Moab. Now think about it for a moment. The youngest daughter gets her father drunk such that he has sex with her sister. She gets pregnant and names her bastard child Moab. Who's your daddy? Creating a constant reminder of what she had done, almost as if she were proud of the incestuous relationship whereby Moab was conceived. It's very much like she's thrumming her nose at God for having saved her.
Absolutely.
For having taken her family out of Sodom. It's like Christians taunting Yahweh by not only naming their Savior, Jesus Christ, rather than Yahusha, but then bowing down before their dead and tortured God on a stick. It's so stunningly sad. You know, I'm just reading this again. I'm in all the Christians this great, but Jesus of Nazareth. Yeah, I read a very, very well researched article by an archaeologist on Nazareth a couple of days ago, and the town, which had an entirely different name, was a little backwater settlement that was destroyed during the Assyrian onslaught. What about 600 plus BCE? That's when they unearthed all the pottery, and the pottery all just nothing there after dates right to the Assyrian onslaught, and then nothing in this little town. And there is no evidence that the site was occupied again until well into the third century. So in the 4th century, when Constantine's mommy came there, there was a place called Nazareth. And because he was Nazir, the branch, she said, I must have come from this place. So he became Jesus of Nazareth. Everything that Christians do, thumbs their nose at God's story. The metaphor he should have been known by is the branch, not the Mashiach. If you want to know the Mashiach is Dode. It's not Yosha.
Yeah.
Dode is absolutely unequivocally the Mashiach. Yosha was never anointed with oil. That's the method. Never. And, of course, the kingdom in the end is the kingdom of Dode, not of some Jesus Christ. Well, mankind has had a propensity to be sexually twisted. Humanity has hit an all-time low today, especially here in South Florida. I can tell you. But you're the West in general. Moab. Yeah, you have San Francisco, which I guess is still number one. And, District of Columbia, I think, is number two. And I actually have, for a future chapter, I actually have the percentage of odd sexual behaviors by region. So it's kind of an insightful thing. And today, you know, they have a really fancy way of describing them. It's LGBTQIA. I've got $100 for you, Kirk, if you know what LGBTQIA all represents.
Well, I have a cheat sheet, so I can't say, but
okay. All right, well, thank you for being honest.
I would be.
But that is the thing today. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was up with it when, I just understood that lesbian, bi, gay, and transsexual, and I wondered why, you know, if you're a lesbian, you're gay. Yeah, if you're a lesbian, you're gay. So why you needed all of it? And I understand why they want to put bisexual in, because you got no meaningful percentage of the population unless you put bisexual. You put bisexual in all of a sudden now, particularly with young girls, you know, you're dealing with
numbers.
Yeah, 20-30%. But, you know, lesbian might be 2%. Homosexual men might represent 1% of the male population. But LBG, lesbian, bisexual, gay, T is transgender. I mean, transgender is a tiny, tiny, tiny percentage of 1%. Q, who would have thought, that you would use this term? What Q stands for? Yeah. Queer. Queer used to mean, if you call somebody queer, you got slapped.
I used it quite a lot when I was young.
Yeah, queer used to be, well, it is strange. I think everybody knows why my view of homosexuality is, I don't care. Really, I just don't care. My neighbors all around me are all homosexual. We get along great. We laugh together. We eat together. I've got no problems if people are homosexual. Not my thing. I do not parade my heterosexuality. They do not parade their homosexuality. They clearly are. They're couples. You know, God's opposed to it being promoted as normal, and he's opposed to the corruption of it from the point of view of his covenant and the way that a man and woman come together to raise children. But, you know, the Torah is a, and the prophets, it's a really, really, really long book. And the amount that God has to say about homosexuality is not even a tempest in a teacup. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to tell you, there are things that God's a lot more concerned about than homosexuality, so it just doesn't bother me all that much. But this idea that we're going to promote an agenda of LGBTQ, and we're going to say, being a queer man, that is the cat's meow. I is for intersex. Now, I've learned a lot about sex I didn't previously know with little Asher here, my Labrador puppy. She's now 5 months. We call her here in South Florida trisexual, because she'll try anything. She's just, we also call her Miss Wigglesworth. She is heir to the Wigglesworth fortune, because every time she meets somebody, she is just all Wiggles. But she doesn't care if it's a cat or a dog, or if it's a man or a woman. She's just all about loving everybody. So we have, in fact, someday maybe this movement will change their T from transgender to trisexual. But I is for intersex, whatever that means.
Let's go with I. Oh, omni.
Okay, we need an omnisex. I'm an omnivore because I was selling my steak. Yeah, the omnivore today, I had a little P.F. Chang's, for those of you who know P.F. Chang's, and lettuce wrap and Mongolian beef, and my P.F. Chang's, and of course, you know, if you have the lettuce and the beef, you are an omnivore. And A is asexual.
Now, like it so.
Typically, when somebody is A something, that means they don't like it. You know, apolitical. So I don't know what. I guess asexual means not
really
there. Anyway, I can tell you for certain, having read the story of Sodom, that they would be all over that. You know, they probably had regular Sunday morning meetings of the LGBTQIA assembly. But you know that in America, 67% of Americans approve and actually support the agenda of LGBTQIA?
Power of political correctness.
Yes. 85% of those who identify with them vote for the most politically correct socialist candidate. Now, if that's not Moab represented by Sodom, or Sodom represented by Moab, where do you need to look? And so it's just so obvious that when Moab is equated by Yahweh with Sodom, who he's talking about today? We also find analogous strokes in religion, because in similar fashion to the Christian New Testament and the Islamic Quran, even the Talmud, the foundation of the Moabite religion was the Hebrew text. Words they twisted to serve their agenda. You know, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam all claim that the Hebrew witness of the, in quotes, Old Testament was not only inspired by their God, but that it legitimizes their religion. The fact that Yahweh's testimony actually condemns all three will be lost on the adherents of modern-day Moab until these prophecies play out against them. So we ought to pay attention to that, because there's something very unique about the death of Moab. The death of Moab, just like the death of the northern kingdom of Israel, mm-hmm. and just like the respite that Jerusalem got when the Assyrians surrounded them with 185,000 person army, those three events are all detailed by the opposing side. Matter of fact, I would be willing to bet that the oldest text of confirming a story found in the writings, because this Moab story is told both in Chronicles and Kings, that the oldest text that we have found thus far validating Yahweh's name, spelling it correctly, and presenting Mishe as the king, who is the king of, you know, the demise of Moab. He's the king. And validating Yahweh's concern for the gods that they worshipped and their propensity to conduct human sacrifice. It's all there, and it was written by Mishe, who escaped the demise of his country, because the Jews just became disgusted at the end when they saw him burning his own son alive to appease Chemosh, his god. They just left. They just said, "What are we doing here? We're supposed to be different. Look what we caused." And they just left. But it's written in Hebrew. The Mishnah Steel is written in Hebrew. It's not the Kirk, the Paleo Hebrew, what we call Paleo Hebrew we use because it's the oldest version of it, which actually has the caricatures that depict, you know, the meaning of the word just by the way they're drawn. It's the next iteration of it. So it's the second iteration of the Hebrew language is what the Moabite stone was written in, which just makes sense for that time. To understand Moab, it's important to understand two things. One is that the details that describe this long extinct kingdom are not only presented in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. It's also been verified in Hebrew writings carved into stones from the kings that were on the opposite side of this. Now that's amazing. And also that it validates that the earliest alphabet known to man, Hebrew, there is no other document written with an alphabet that predates it. And so you can just not only have affirmation of this, but the insights. What religions today are derived from a corruption of the Hebrew text? Christianity, Islam, and Rabbinic Judaism. Mm-hmm. So, as we recognize that all of these human schemes, whether they be Judaism, Christianity, Islam, all have a well-documented history of capricious relationships with Israel and with the Israelites. That was the unique thing about Moab, but sometimes the Moabites were really close to the Jews. In fact, when King Shaul was trying to hunt down and kill Dod, he sent his parents into Moab because he said, "I can trust you." You know, Moab became part of Israel for a while. There were really cozy relationships between Israelites and Moabites. But then there were the wars. And ultimately, Israel, in conjunction with Yehuda, savagely wiped Moab out. So you've got capricious relationships. So we can look at what are the other institutions that have capricious relationships with Israel, at times admiring them and at times envying them and other times maneuvering to destroy them.
United States, certainly.
Yeah, the United States, clearly. Protestant Christianity, academia, political elitists, especially socialist secular humanists. Even the name Moab, who and what is your father, who is your daddy, even questionable father, is not such a subtle reminder that Lot's descendants were fathered inappropriately. Play that idea forward today, and we find that the majority of children are born out of wedlock, and many have no relationship whatsoever with their fathers. This, too, is a product of socialist secular humanism. But in this vein, Moab, questionable father, also points an accusatory finger at Akiba, the questionable father of Rabbinic Judaism, Mohammed, the perverted father of Islam, and especially towards Shaul, question him, Paul, the appalling father of biblical Christianity. The answer to the question Moab poses, who were the men who fathered the world's leading political and religious schemes? False prophets and deceivers. Now, beyond this, we've talked in the past about Adam Weishaupt, who I probably have given too much credit to, for political correctness and socialist secular humanism and indeed political correctness. What I would say now is he's the one that advanced the cause of the very things that Paul conceived by way of his Illuminist war against the rule of Catholic cleric and king. And, you know, and in Christianity, long before Adam Weishaupt, Paul is the man most responsible for what the world endured in the West, all through Europe, and for years even the Americas, of this union between church and state. Paul's responsible.
Absolutely.
You know, Paul is writing his religious diatribe, and in the middle of it, both in Hebrews and Romans, he stops and says that all governments were established by God. You need to submit to them. You know, at the time, he's writing a letter to the Romans. It's interesting. He wrote the letter to the Romans in Greece, and he wrote the letter to the Hebrews in Rome. And multicultural, for sure. But just think about that. He's writing it to and on behalf of the Romans, and he's saying that that government, as well as all other governments, have always been God's servants, and he ought to obey them. Last time I checked, who was it that whipped the flesh right off of Yosha?
The Romans.
Who crucified him?
Romans again.
The Romans.
Who decided that they would tear down Yahweh's temple and use the proceeds to build their decadent Colosseum?
Rome again.
Who came back 70 years later to completely destroy Jerusalem, to build a temple to men and to false gods on the Temple Mount, and assault the land and rename the place?
And that was Hadrian, right? Still Roman.
Yeah. Last time I checked, it was Roman. When Constantine had his edict that all religious faiths are okie dokie, save one. You can't be Torah observant. He was a Roman emperor, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Who was the fellow that created the transition from the imperial Roman beast, the most vicious, to the beast that would tread upon the whole world? That guy was Theodosius, wasn't he?
Yeah.
That's how I checked. He was a Roman. Nero was a Roman, wasn't he?
Yeah,
he was God's man, wasn't he? Claudius?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was God's man. Yeah. How about Caligula? How do I Paul? He was clearly God's man, wasn't he, Caligula? You know, I guess Adolf Hitler in Nazi Germany must have been, it's in all governments, must have been God's man. You know, one of the things that we ought not have done when God talked about the beast that would tread upon the whole world and how Imperial Rome, the vicious beast, would evolve into the Roman Catholic Church. Imperial Rome was the First Reich. Roman Catholicism the Second. What is Hitler called? Nazi Germany.
Third Reich. That was the Third Reich.
That's what he's talking about. It's an incarnation of Imperial Rome. And you know the man that's most responsible for the Third Reich, besides Adolf Hitler? Pope Pius the XII.
Oh, yes, because of the article.
Pope Pius the XII. The Third Reich. It's the third iteration of Roman Catholicism. We ought not ever forget that in terms of the prophecies. It is the legacy is all there for us to understand. Now, you know, Adam Weishaupt was a fellow that put a significant crimp in the get-along of Roman Catholicism. He's the person who actually undermined what Paul had written, trying to unify cleric and king. And he was really successful in that regard. In today's vernacular, and speaking of someone who is controlled by another, the victor will taunt the loser by saying, "Who's your daddy?" Well, Paul would be the daddy of all of these things.
Mm-hmm.
As a result of these factors and cognizant of how condemning these next two chapters of Yahshayahu, the 15th and 16th of Isaiah, it's going to be Shaul Paul that we find ourselves migrating to, following the depiction of what Moab may represent today of a questionable father, and that it all boils down to what that man did. And, you know, I might be saying we're making too big a deal about Paul. You know, Paul didn't have to be, and he wasn't, the sharpest tool in the shed. He was a horrible writer, a horrible speaker. He was irrational. He was out of control and just mean. Paul would have been forgotten if it hadn't been for the fact that there was that Rome picked up his mantra. Mm-hmm. It'd have been meaningless. And almost everything that he did was plagiarized from another source. It's just like Muhammad. Muhammad, you know, the 1.5 billion followers, that doesn't make Muhammad smart. No, he was a ruthless scumbag, a rapist, a pedophile, just a two-bit thug. But men said, you know, this is Tamerlane, for example, said, man, I want to go and bludgeon a bunch of people and rob them. And Islam is my religion. I can get people to give me their lives in pursuit of my agenda. Well, it's the same thing with Paul. So we don't want to overhype the individual in terms of his accomplishments. He has more influence. He and Muhammad have more influence in the world today than any other two people. But it's in both their cases, it was because they plagiarized and bastardized the work of others and created something that was picked up that was used in a very horrible way.
Yeah.
You know, and as we expanded farther, Moab is the embodiment of Lot's son, one conceived through his eldest daughter, representing an unthinking, warlike, immoral, and multicultural religious and political culture born out of incest after being indoctrinated in the cesspool of Sodom. Misled by a religion which twisted and intermixed the Hebrew writings with pagan lore, as would later be the case with Christianity and Islam, and therefore analogous to the place where the Torah's voice died. Now, while these indications might be few and far between today, the existence of Moab has now been affirmed four times outside of the Torah and prophets. Once through archaeology and digs in Jordan, so that there's archaeological digs in Jordan. That's the Moabite or Mishay stone. Once in Egyptian hieroglyphics that are in display in Luxor, and twice by Assyrian kings. The foremost amongst these, the Mishay stele, reveals how the Moabite king Mishay tried to save face, presenting the destruction of his kingdom as a victory. It's kind of like Saddam Hussein, how he won the mother of all battles, hiding out in a little hole underground, only to be killed. But Mishay wrote on his stone, there was a great victory for him. But it affirms the same story that you find in the Malak, Two Kings. Now, it was unearthed in Jordan in 1868. And it's particularly fascinating because it was written by Moabites using the second earliest example of the Paleo-Hebrew alphabet language. The second affirmation of the otherwise insignificant ancient kingdom was found in the religious enclave of Egypt, where the name was engraved on a colossal statue in Luxor erected by Pharaoh Ramses II in the 13th century BCE. The Egyptian king lists Moab among a series of places he subdued during a campaign. The Nimrud clay inscription of Taglath-Pilaster III, circa 745 to 727 BCE, reveals that the Moabite king Shalman, who is said to have sacked Beth Arbel and Hosha, was a tributary of Syria. In other words, he robbed his own people to appease the Assyrians. And it indicates that the kingdom was no longer autonomous by the time of Sargon II, 721 to 705. It also mentions the region, revealing that he had suppressed an uprising in the territories of Moab, Peleth, and Edom, also confirming what then lastly, there's the Taylor Prism, which recounts the expedition against Hezekiah. We read that Chemosh Nabob, king of Moab, brings tribute to Sargon, his Caesarian. That is to say, by the time that Yeshayah and Yirmiyah wrote their prophecies against Moab, depicting their ultimate destruction, there was very little of anything left of the otherwise insignificant kingdom. The kingdom itself, during its day, was about the size of Yehuda. Now, Yehuda is not today's Israel. It's not even 1/12 of what you would call Israel. Yehuda was a really tiny, tiny land grant by Yah. It's on the opposite side of the Dead Sea. See, the tiny kingdom is presented, by the way, the Dead Sea is where Sodom was and Gomorrah. It's presented in conflict and at peace with Israel. The plateau upon which it's located rises about 4,000 feet above the Dead Sea, and it's surrounded by rugged, mountainous, desolate terrain. Today, it is littered with ruins from the Roman and Byzantine periods, and is chiefly occupied by Bedouin tribes. As it sits in 2019, there's nothing about Moab that would warrant prophetic exposure of any kind, much less the kind we're about to entertain in Yeshayah 15 and 16.
You know, before you go too far on to something else, this is such unbelievable confirmation of the truths of the Torah. I mean, it's just, it's really, really powerful stuff.
I look at those
things individually and go, wow.
I think one of the things that people miss is that it's true that Yahweh absolutely proves his existence through prophecy, and we think of prophecy as predicting the future, because only a spirit that is free of the constraints of time can do that, report our future and our past so that we know that he authored what he wrote. But you know, when he presents that test, Kirk, on the body of how do you know if I said something?
Yes.
It's not just that which will come. It's also Haya, that which exists. Yeah, what was. That's exactly right. And it wasn't until really coming to understand Hebrew, this language that doesn't have a past, present, and future tense, and the difference, why God would use both Haya and Bo to describe accuracy of events. He's talking about part of the proof that he is who he is that his depiction of these ancient kingdoms and people prove that he authored this. Because the only other comprehensive ancient document that purports to cover people and places would be the Iliad. Now, to some degree, the Odyssey. But everything is fanciful. All sorts of things that didn't happen and that are wrapped up with false gods and rubbish. When Yahweh says the king's name was Mishay, proven. All of it. And so it's just one of those things that if you're paying attention, the argument that scholars used to make was that there's no independent record of any of these things and places and people, and so they're all just kind of fairy tales. So there are every single argument has fallen. We found them all.
And so I've been reading, based on your recommendation a while back, David Rohl's The Test of Time. There's so much that's come out even since then, but it makes a great case on that very point of just how historically accurate it is.
Yes.
It's amazing.
Yeah, Joseph's home there. How the firstborn male children were killed. The settlement in Goshen supported that large a population of slaves. Even the prophecy that that preceded it all, with the 7 years of feast followed by 7 years of famine, and how the markings on the cliffs of the Nile dating to that time, proof that it was true. All of agricultural reforms and the storehouses that he had built to store grain during the times of plenty, so the people wouldn't starve during the times that were lean. It's all been found. All of it. You know, I remember Penn and Teller doing their bit on, that how Exodus was a farce, there were never Jews in Egypt, and the whole thing's a fairy tale. Sorry, boys. Joke's on you.
Yep, and disproven.
Yeah. And even, as you say, even more since that time. You know, so it's there for us to enjoy. And I'm certain, and we've spent a lot of time on it tonight. And I think it's important for newer listeners to know that one of the reasons that you can trust what we're sharing, the insights derived from Yahweh's Torah, prophets, and Psalms, is because he is 100% accurate, historically 100% accurate, scientifically 100% accurate in terms of future prophecies. But that isn't what we enjoy the most. In fact, it's not even 1% of what we enjoy the most. Mm-hmm. And what we enjoy is the camaraderie, the teaching, the insights, the brilliance, coming to understand who God is, what he's offering, what he wants in return. And just the brilliance of the way he communicates.
I couldn't find a single religion that talked about God wanting a family from a father relationship. You know, I went through all those religions, and I'm going, where is it? Everything is Baal. Everything is a Lord. Everything is exploitation. I mean, it's just, okay, what do you pay for?
You know, I was, I've been in the process the last few days of translating the first 7 Mizmorim only into the second of the first 7, so it's going to be a project for this the third volume. But wouldn't you know? I mean, this is the kind of stuff that really trips my trigger. Do you know the first word that Dode ever wrote? The word that caused Dode to become the most prolific writer in the history of Yahweh's message. What do you think that the first word is that Dode wrote in his first Mizmor?
Don't know. How about you, J.B.?
What's the word that began all of this? What's the word that began all of this?
Asher?
That's it. Asher.
Wow.
I read that and I was like dumbstruck for an hour. Asher. And it's the third word, too. In fact, let me read it to you because it's an amazing insight. It says, joyful and blessed, fortunate, and this is Asher. And this is Asher with a suffix of Yah's hand at the end of it. So it's Asher plus the suffix of Yah's hand. Fortunate and happy in the relationship, stepping along the straightforward and correct path, which gives meaning to life, providing the proper place to stand and live, is the individual who, as a result of the relationship, Asher again, who is elevated and favored through the association tie, taking the proper strides to live a productive and prosperous, blessed and joyful life, does not walk in the counsel of those who are incorrect, does not stand in the way of those who are wrong, nor dwells in the communities of those who babble, scoff, and ridicule. But instead, he desires and delights in Yahweh's Torah. And his Torah teaching, he meditates, giving serious thought and consideration to the information day and night. That's Dode's first sentence.
That's pretty
awesome. Don't be religious. Don't be political. Don't wisdom demands babble. Instead, pay attention to the Torah. Don't just read the Torah. Fall in love with it. How's that for an opening act? And here you find out that the word that really brought us all to where we are, it all began with Asher. And it's exactly the same thing for Dode. The first and the third word that he wrote. Then he says, and remember when we talk about the fact that branches, what it's all about, the branch off the tree of lives and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, that Dode represents the branch, Yosha represents the branch, that the metaphor God's trying to convey to us is that we want to be rooted in God's testimony and the promised land and Yisrael, and we want our branches to be growing off, our stems to be growing off the branch of Dode and Yosha. Mm-hmm. They represent the tree of lives and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Well, he says, and he is like a tree planted near an idyllic flowing stream of water. What is the word that's the basis of Torah? Yara. It means source from which guidance and teaching flow. So he is like a tree planted near a flowing stream of water, such that as a result of this beneficial relationship, Asher, he produces and bestows his fruit in his appointed time. Do you know what Yosha's what's called Sermon on the Mount, his instruction on the Mount? Now, it's all Torah, 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 Torah. Don't even listen to anybody who presents anything other than I'm committed to the Torah. And, of course, Christianity is about annulling the Torah. But Yosha actually gets into a bit of a diatribe. He's got like 10, 12 sentences on fruit and trees. Guess what his source was? Right here. This is the basis of his instruction on the mount. It is uplifting, or its uplifting branches and foliage will never wither, and he will never lack understanding. If you're rooted in the Torah, if the flow of the Torah's teaching is where you are planted, where you draw sustenance, you will never lack for understanding. Your branches and your foliage will never wither. Never lack for understanding. And everything that he engages in, Asher, to show the way to the benefits of the relationship, he will succeed and prosper. Successfully accomplishing the mission. Be useful and thrive. Win the argument and be acquitted. You know, I've lost my share of battles along the way, but sure, I've been outmaneuvered in business arguments along the way. You know something? I've done 10,000 radio shows. I've never lost an argument when speaking on behalf of Yahweh. Never.
Phenomenal.
Understanding is a powerful tool. You know, we are so blessed to have God's perspective. Extraordinarily powerful thing.
That's why you got
this. It is not so with those who are incorrect, but who rather instead are like the chaff which is driven away by the Spirit. You know, I thought for a moment, what percentage? Ever considered how tiny the edible seed is or kernel compared to its roots, stems, leaves, and husk of the plant? And even this infinitesimal tiny piece of the plant represents Israel. For the rest of the world, it's smaller still. There's two more lines in the first Mizmor Psalm. Therefore, those who are incorrect will not stand upright during judgment, nor those who are wrong in the enduring community of witnesses who are upright, correct, and vindicated. You want to know why every knee will bow? Because he's talking about the leaders of the earth. They're not going to be able to stand during judgment. They'll be bowed down before the rest of us. Indeed, because Yahweh knows the way of those who are upright, correct, and vindicated, but those whose path is incorrect, they're going to perish. Isn't that a powerful opening? That's the first Mizmor. The second, by the way, is devoted to, opens anyway, with what I think is the greatest regret of our time. Conspiracy. And that's the second Mizmor. The second Mizmor is Dode's attack on conspiracy. And you might say, well, that's really overstated to say that conspiracy is the dirge of our time. But you know what the single most important conspiracy of the last 100 years, what it was and who sponsored it? Elders of the Protocols of Zion.
Yes.
Written, the book, the French book that it was based upon was a couple of devils that were just a cute little story. A couple of devils having an argument. And it was changed deliberately by a Russian communist who was also very religious, a Christian. And he's the one that initially rewrote the story of putting the Jews in their place. You know who published it? 500,000 copies of it to disseminate around the world. Nope.
No?
Henry Ford. Henry Ford.
Yeah, I knew that one.
Yeah, Henry Ford. And you know who the number one promoter was of it? A Roman Catholic priest. The first religious cleric to have his own nationally syndicated radio and television show.
Oh, is that old
as the elders of the Protocols of Zion. And what was the consequence of it? 6 million dead Jews.
Yeah.
Greatest conspiracy of our time. Most deadly conspiracy of all time. And conspiracy is not a bunch of nincompoops incapable of thinking, promoting stupid ideas. I mean, today, you know, I think there's been 700 cases of measles here recently. Church of Scientology had a cruise ship. They just quarantined the whole ship because of the outbreak of measles. Why is there an outbreak of measles? Because of the conspirators coming up with this myth that the measles vaccine causes all sorts of the government plot and causes all sorts of negative effects, including autism. Conspiracy is really deadly stuff. And it's not just deadly on Jews. And of course, the Jews, the more conspiracies have been against Jews than anyone else. And most conspirators down deep are anti-Semitic. But when you really look at it, Christianity, Pauline Christianity, Islam, is a conspiracy against Jehovah. They're both conspiracies against Jehovah. God hates a conspiracy. That's what the second Mizmor opens with. So there's God's had his son Dode convey a lot of stuff to us. And in fact, in the second Mizmor, Dode refers to himself as both the son and the Messiah. God was anointed. So we really have some marvelous things to learn. We're going to continue, if you guys are up to it, just a little bit longer and on Moab, and then we'll pick it up again next week. And then we're nearing, hopefully, the end here of the narrative of just thinking about what Moab represents, and then we'll dig into, we'll begin with the story of Sodom immediately thereafter. But the first mention of Moab is found in Bereshit in the beginning, Genesis 19. And that's where we're going to head next week. And so I think it's important to share it here because it's important that we appreciate the conception and evolution of Moab from God's perspective. This story is the one depicting life in Sodom and Gomorrah. It's something that, I don't know about you guys, but it's a story that I just shunned. It just didn't seem to me to be something that we're going to learn a lot from. It was going to be uplifting. For me, it was kind of like, do I want to go back into the world of Islam, you know, and it's just so perverted. Mm-hmm. You know, because, you know, it was the story of Sodom. You know, it's told right after Yahweh's sixth meeting with Abraham and the and this last one. It's right before Abraham is asked to take Isaac Moriah as a dress rehearsal for the fulfillment of Pesach. And his placement is right there in the middle of the covenant story. So you don't think that God interrupted the single most important story he ever told. With the account of what happened in Sodom, just because it's sensational. And what I came to realize is that the story of Sodom represents the story of the broken human family. So that you have a clear indication of that the covenant family and the Sodom family are wholly and completely distinct. The family of man that Yahweh was asking Abraham to walk away from is represented by Sodom. It's fractured. Its values are all screwed up. And so it's there to be the contrast. It's there while, you know, Yahweh's telling this wonderful story about life in the garden, and all of a sudden the snake slithers in. There to be the contrast. Sodom is the option. The human, broken human family as opposed to Yahweh's covenant family. It's a tawdry beginning to its unsavory conclusion. It appears to tarnish every aspect of the familial relationship God intended. And yet it was interjected between the presentation of the covenant's final condition, circumcision, and Enoch's impending birth in Bereshit 17, and the confirmation of the covenant with Abraham and Enoch in Bereshit 22, where we are reintroduced to Pesach, Passover, as the doorway to life into the covenant home. It is initially presented, of course, you know, in the first presentation of the Pesach door, his presentation is in Noah's Ark, and with the seven clean animals along with for the ride. And it will be reintroduced right here and underscored several times. Now, whether this is the first or the 18th book that I've had the pleasure of composing over these past 18 years that you may have listened to as part of this program or read, you know, you and I have had the privilege of seeing God as very few have before, of coming to know who he is, of realizing what he's offering, and of reflecting on what he expects in return. Along this journey, we've been exposed to many thousands of marvelously enlightening insights, many of which hadn't been uncovered or discussed by anyone during the past two millennia. But now, we're on the cusp of something extraordinary. Beneath the searing blue light and pungent smell of burning sulfur, well past the pillar of salt, a story of a father allegedly offering up his virgin daughters to be gang raped to protect the invincible, only to impregnate both in an intoxicated and incestuous super, may actually be a referendum between man's way, institutionalized Babel, and God's way. The Torah's Bereth family. Perhaps this horrific portrayal of societal and familial corruption is our Heavenly Father's way of making certain that we appreciate exactly what He is asking us to walk away from before we affirm our desire to be with Him. Let's just go over the first statement that Diana made about this story and how it begins, and then we'll pick it up again here next week.
Okay.
The two spiritual messengers, Ha-Shanaim, Ha-Malak. So a pair of spiritual envoys, supernatural envoys, came to, arrived at Sodom. It's C-D-M in Hebrew. It's Kadom. Sodom, scorched and burning. They arrived in the evening. Baha Arab. During the time that light and darkness are mixed together and joined together, creating a grayish interwoven fabric at dusk as the world grows ever darker. While Lot means enveloped and intertwined. Lot, the one wrapped too tightly, who was encircled, encased, and entangled. Set. Settle down. In the doorway, Ba-Sha'ar, within the gateway, the entrance, the opening of Sodom. Now, we will ponder that this time next week.
Yeah. And don't wait.
But boy, there's some insights.
I'm going to try and read the whole chapter before then.
I'll send you the most recent version of it. It's you're in for a treat, I'll tell you. It is where Yahweh takes us with the birth and the demise of Moab, and then his prophecies about their ultimate demise here in not so many years. The thing, as I said, that I came to really love about prophecy wasn't the prophetic proof, but the teaching that always accompanied it. And that's what we're going to find here. It's the teaching that accompanies the prophecy.
You know, that's what's actually really great about Yahweh's word is, it gets you in there. Originally, you're looking at it for just trying to verify. And once you do that, you're like, okay, then you get deeper into it. And that's when you start getting all the nuances of it. So
right.
The fact that it can provide on all those levels is what's amazing.
Yes. Yeah, and that's the thrill of what we're going to come through here, is how it speaks to us on so many different levels. It talks about our history and our past, our present, our future, our wants and desires, and how there's such a difference between the human family and family values and what Yahweh values. We'll have a great deal of fun with it, and the long narration is over. We're now into just commenting on Yah's testimony. So I appreciate you guys putting up with me this evening, and look forward to picking this up with you tomorrow.
Next week.
Okay, now next week, Kirk, you're gonna be a two-eyed guy, and Terry's gonna be feeling good.
Well, that is our desire.
All right. Good night, guys.
Good night.
Bye.
Bye.